I'm in the studio with Marshall Ward and Larry Guin of the Callaway County Retired Teachers Association. Gentlemen, glad to have you with me today to unpack the proposed pension reform legislation that Governor Matt Bevin and other Republican state leaders recently unveiled. These are proposed changes to the pension system, and they released a series of highlights that would be in a forthcoming bill. Perhaps as expected, this has garnered a range of reactions, some praise for tackling the overall issue and criticism from those affected by the changes, namely groups representing teachers and retired teachers. Before we jump into the details, what are your overall assessments as representatives of one of these groups?
I'll go ahead and start if that's okay, Larry.
Sure.
I think probably what concerns me the most is the rhetoric that the leadership in Frankfort puts out that is both bombastic and somewhat confusing. Teachers who are in the classroom right now are obviously making plans, especially those who are perhaps within 5 years of retirement. And those who are just entering their profession are becoming very nervous, if you will, as to their prospects. One of the things that teachers do, and I think most people out there may know this, is that you basically have a trade-off when you choose this profession. You're going to take a fairly low pay up front in order to perhaps garner a nice pension at the very end. And when I say nice pension, you contribute to that all along the way. And of course, it's matched by state funding. But if you are perhaps looking at this profession from the outside, going in as an 18-year-old, you may decide very quickly this is not for you because the salaries and benefits are just not there for you to be able to sustain that livelihood, plus have a family and those kinds of issues like everybody else worries about. We will, if this doesn't play out well, we will have a teacher shortage in Kentucky fairly quickly.
I would agree with that. I'm also a bit concerned about just kind of all the finger pointing that's going on. This is a problem that should be shared by a lot of different people. There were mistakes that were made along the way. We've kicked the can down the road now for about 15 years, and it's finally coming home to roost. To Governor Bevin's credit, he is addressing the problem. That's something that previous governors have not done, and I would applaud him for that. I may differ with a few issues in his particular plan, but I very much appreciate the fact that they are looking at it now.
How many employees are in the system overall, and how many teachers would be affected by this?
Marshall and I are here representing the teachers primarily. There are actually 8 pension plans in the state of Kentucky, of which the teachers retirement system, formerly known as KTRS, is one. The teachers retirement system has roughly about 133,000 members. This is about one-third of the size of the non-teaching retirees and employees that are out there, which is about 365,000 members. So we're about one-fourth, roughly, of the total.
Governor Bevin has said that it's simply not possible for the system to continue on without any changes. What do you make of that? Is it possible for the system to continue the way it is?
No, definitely not. He is certainly correct in that. The system would... It would take down the entire Commonwealth of Kentucky eventually. Bankruptcy would be the inevitable result because the losses here, the amounts of money that are required are staggering. The unfunded liabilities right now for all of the systems are estimated to be about $33 million. But there is a new set of accounting rules that have been implemented at the national level regarding pensions. And if you take those into account, really, rather than for KTRS or TRS, rather than about 54% funded, under the new guidelines would be about 45% funded. And to get that up to a reasonable level, and the rest of the state and the other pension fund systems, would probably take in the neighborhood of about $45 billion under the new accounting rules. The state budget last year was approximately $10 billion. So to give you an idea of the magnitude of the side, it's about 4.5 budget years.
To the level of what this impact means for a teacher or retired teacher depends somewhat on their career path. Can we go through these different stages?
Go ahead, Larry. You're the actuarialist. You have numbers and I have theory, but go ahead. I'd like for you to answer that if you don't mind.
Well, just to help our audience a bit, the proposal says that for brand new teachers who are not yet in the system, those who may be a college senior and getting ready to become a teacher next year, those individuals will be required to step into what is most closely described as a 401k type of program. Technically, it's called a defined contribution plan. The governor has used this word several times, and I would differ with him on here. He has called the new defined contribution plan a very generous plan. In my opinion, it is not generous at all. In fact, it's on the other end of the scale, because the state right now is putting in about 9.1% of an employee's salary for their match in the current system. That would drop under the proposal to about 4% by the state. The local school districts would put in another 2%. The employee would be required to put in 9% and could, at their option, increase that to a total of 12%. So if you go to 12%, about two-thirds of all of the contributions into the plan are coming from employee savings, if the employee indeed can save that much. So the state putting in 4% as opposed to 9.1% now does not strike me as generous. That's for new teachers. For the existing teachers who are currently in the system, they can stay under the current defined benefit plan, which is the traditional type of plan that has been around for, I'm not sure when Kentucky started theirs, back in the 30s or 40s, I think.
One of the problems, I think, that most people may not see in this defined contribution issue is that the teacher's salary, which starts out at around $34,000 to $35,000, to be able to put away the kind of money you would need to retire, period, within 30, 35, 40 years, would be probably beyond the ability of that teacher to put that kind of money away and still be able to live a fairly, you know, normal, basic middle-class existence. So, you know, if you're making six figures, maybe you have an opportunity to put that kind of money away, but a $35,000, $40,000 employee for basically the long term of their career with very few pay raises, if any, based on some of these numbers, chances are they won't be able to retire, period. And that's probably, as I said earlier, that was one of the benefits, that the trade-offs that teachers take on when they begin their teaching careers, at a low front-end salary with the faith, if you will, that at the end they will have an opportunity to retire.
Also, under the new system, 27 years is going to become the maximum that the current teachers can stay in their plan right now. If they want to teach beyond 27 years, as many do, most do, then they're going to have to switch to the new defined contribution plan, which in Marshall, in my opinion, is not nearly as attractive as the current plan they're in.
So they'd be shifting to a 401k-like plan. Realistically, what does that look like for somebody who wants to continue working?
There's a phase-in period of 3 years. So let's assume that I'm a teacher in the system. I have now 27 years in the system. I'd like to teach for another 10 years or so. Under the proposal, I would be allowed to teach another 3 years as a phase-in under the defined benefit plan. So I would end up with a total of 30 years in the defined benefit plan. If I want to teach beyond that 30-year total, I would have to switch to the new 401k type of plan then. That would depend upon whatever the stock market is doing over that time and whatever personal savings I may be able to accumulate to reach that 12% level.
And that's where the uncertainty comes in. It's outside factors like how the market is doing.
Well, let's just take a scenario. If you were getting ready to retire in 2008 or 2009 with that huge correction where most people or many people lost maybe 50% of whatever retirement savings they had, then you're not going to be able to do it. So tying your retirement to the market, and I understand a lot of people in the private sector are doing that. But again, we go back to that trade-off that teachers have always made, to make much less up front, to have that guaranteed defined pension program at the end.
I'm a former finance professor here at Murray State University and taught investments for most of my career. Between 2001 and 2013, the rate of return on average for the stock market or the average stock was 0%. It ended up that 13-year period at exactly the same level it began that period for it. We're not living in the 1950s, 60s, 70s anymore, where the stock market would generate pretty consistent 10% rate of returns per year. An article by John Bogle the other day pointed out, who is head of Vanguard Mutual Funds, the largest financial institution of that type in the country, pointed out that going forward, he thinks we're going to be able to earn probably 4% on stocks on average and 3% on bonds. So these days of earning 7, 8, 9% are going to be very difficult to come by in the future. And that makes it very difficult for somebody under a 401k plan.
Something else that's been mentioned by the governor is the issue of Social Security and how teachers are precluded from collecting Social Security. Can you explain that a little bit? And then something that the governor has said is that in meeting with teachers groups, they didn't want to pay into Social Security. Why is that?
Well, I can use myself as an example. I've taught in both South Carolina and Kentucky. In South Carolina, you contributed to their pension plan, as well as I had my Social Security taken out of my check. And I'm now receiving a check from South Carolina and Social Security. And I was kind of surprised that my Social Security check, even though it's been reduced, is quite nice. And I appreciate that fondly. So I think that should be an option on the table. I don't know why the governor has quoted teachers groups. He certainly didn't ask the retired teachers group what they thought about that. So we'll just leave that on the table. But quite frankly, I think that should be an option. There should be lots of options, actually, to make sure we do the right thing by the state and its financial security, as well as the teachers who are working hard at this thing to make sure we have educated children for the future to consume goods and services with great jobs.
And maybe we should clarify here. At the university level, the university professors, like here at Murray State, are covered by Social Security. But K through 12 teachers are not. By state law, they may not participate in Social Security. The governor did say that the local unions, teachers' unions, asked him not to add that as a requirement. Personally, I think the state's trying to save money here, logically, any way that they can. The employer match for Social Security is 6.2% of the employee's salary. And I think the governor shied away from this very quickly when he realized they were going to have to come up with another 6.2% of the salaries for covering Social Security.
Well, another concern also, it seems like we're pushing the responsibility down to the local school district level in terms of some of these matches, which is going to put more burden on an already burdened local school district, whether it's here in Callaway County or in Boone County, Northern Kentucky. So there has to be some shared responsibility, no doubt, but let's make sure that we don't, I hate to use this term, throw the baby out with the bathwater, because quite frankly, we might need to change the bathwater more often, which makes good sense. But let's save the baby.
Speaking of matches, some say the 3% additional contribution into health care is effectively a pay cut for current teachers. Considering rising health care costs, potential tax increases down the road, it could ultimately amount to an even deeper cut. Why would teachers have to pay this 3%, and where is that money going?
I think it caught a lot of us off guard, because our understanding was that as a result of some changes made a few years ago, I want to say maybe 4 or 5, that the healthcare system, for teachers at least, was in pretty good shape. I heard on the KET program the other night, where 4 legislative leaders met with KET, that the healthcare program was underfunded by something like, I think they said, $6 billion. So I'm not sure what the true situation is there. But for whatever reason, I suspect this money is going to go into kind of a general pool anyway. It may or may not end up in healthcare. It may end up in some other pool. But certainly healthcare costs are going up very rapidly, so I'm not surprised if they do end up putting it there.
But it is true, it would be a pay cut, 3%. And quite frankly, local school districts, if they have additional burden, it'll be very difficult to have any kind of pay raises for the foreseeable future, probably statewide, as well as locally. And that would make it even more arduous for teachers to figure out a way to pay some of the bills that they do. I mean, come on, we're talking about people who have the same hopes and dreams for their children, college tuition, living in a nice place, driving a nice car occasionally, blah. So it's really interesting that for whatever reason, the teaching group has been kind of attacked unfairly as being somehow greedy and living on and getting addicted to the public dole. That's so far from the truth, it's almost comical.
Talking about sort of the shifting social dynamic, something that the governor has said is that young people, millennials, prefer the 401k style contribution because it allows them some flexibility to shift careers over their time, and that the days of the 27 years of service are perhaps of a bygone era. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I would agree that 401k plans are certainly portable. They can be taken with you from, you know, job to job. But it's also true that once you're vested in the defined benefit plan, you can leave that money in the plan, and when you do retire then at age 66 or whatever it may be, then you can start withdrawing your money from that plan. For example, I taught at Montana State University before I moved to Murray State University. And at that time, I was under a defined benefit plan. I had the option of pulling the money out, my cash portion. I could not pull the employer's portion out, their match. But I could take that money with me and bring it down here to Kentucky. Or I could leave it in, and when I did retire eventually here in Kentucky, then I could file in the state of Montana to withdraw that money too. And that way I get to keep the employer match as well as mine and draw it out over a monthly basis then. So the portability issue is not a strong one, I think, with people. Certainly the millennials are probably more familiar with a 401k because defined benefit plans have been cut back and back and back by corporations, particularly in the country. So they're less of a factor than they used to be.
If I could ask Larry just to clarify one thing. Larry, earlier today you mentioned the benefit of the defined benefit program and how healthy it is here in Kentucky compared to maybe some other types of plans.
Yes, there's a lot of talk about changing the structure, and by that they mean going from a defined benefit plan to a 401k. There's really nothing wrong with a defined benefit plan. The structure is actuarially sound, but it does require financial discipline, and that's where the system is broken down. It's not the type of plan. It's not that a 401k is better than a defined benefit plan or vice versa. They're both very viable plans, but they both require financial discipline, and especially the defined benefit plan. The employer has to put in their money on time in the amount that they promised. The employees have to contribute theirs on time, as they've been promised to do also. And if you get a reasonable rate of return on the investments, they're 100% funded and they do very well. We've ended up with this problem largely from two or three reasons. One is the state, going back to Governor Paul Patton, Governor Ernie Fletcher, both of those governors pulled money out of the pension fund and used it for other purposes. I have an article here in front of me from 2005. Governor Fletcher says, we'll address the problem later of paying it back. We will pay it back, but we'll handle that at the appropriate time. But that seemed to be the attitude, and it got kicked down the road and down the road. By the time it got to Governor Beshear, he simply pulled it out of the budget entirely. They contributed no money for a period of 8 years. So there's nothing wrong with the defined benefit plan, but the employer has to live up to their responsibilities, as does the employee, as do the people who manage the money to earn a rate of return on it.
Is there an example of a system working well in a state?
Well, I'm thinking of, and I got this information from Ken Wolf, who studied this. He thought that the Missouri plan, which is a hybrid plan, some contributions, some defined benefits, in which the amount contributed by the employer and employee changes as the economy changes. So there's a sliding scale. It's kind of a variable type plan. I'm not exactly sure how long that's been in effect, but that might be something that would be a good compromise here in Kentucky to allow some flexibility for the employer and the employee.
Governor Bevin has said that people opposed to this haven't offered alternative suggestions. So I guess my question to dive further into that previous one is, what is there an alternative fix, and what are some suggestions that you might have?
Well, obviously, there are probably a whole host of varieties of fixes. I think what we probably need to do is, first of all, take a look at what hasn't worked. West Virginia, 20 years ago, tried to do this switch. They switched to a defined contribution type plan, and they found that that was not adequate for their employees or even the employer. It became actually, in some cases, more expensive. And so they actually went back to the defined pension program in West Virginia. I'm not exactly sure when that was, but that might be a very good place to start to see what other states have done that didn't work with this type of model. As far as the positive model, I'll go back to Missouri. I think that would be one to study for sure. As far as the other options, I would leave that to somebody like Larry, who understands the numbers much better than I do.
Well, I think we put too many constraints on the solution here, because the Republican leadership has said the Republican Party does not stand for tax increases, so we're not going down that road. But there is another option, too. One of the Lexington or TV stations recently had a little news clip that said, when talking about tax loopholes that are in our current code, our state budget is about $10 billion, roughly, 10 plus. There are $13 billion worth of what may be considered tax loopholes. For example, there are credits, tax credits, given to wealthy individuals who own boats that they end up paying fewer taxes than the fishing boat right next to them. The movie industry receives a great deal of movie credits here, and there's no evidence that's being paying itself off in terms of increased economic activity. Now, there are a lot of other things that they call tax credits that maybe most of us, most of our listeners, wouldn't agree with. For example, there is no sales tax if we consult an accountant or an attorney or a doctor or something like that. We don't have to pay a sales tax on services. If that were enacted, I think their numbers, well, up in the billions of dollars. I think they said $3.1 billion could be brought in by that. We don't pay tax on medicines and groceries, and that was, I think, somewhere around $1 billion also. Now, that's a tax increase. Maybe that's not a tax loophole, but there are certainly loopholes out there that help to build golf courses and pet projects of legislators and things like that. The racehorse industry, for example, for racehorses or horses that are less than 2 years old, there are tremendous credits for that. So there are just literally hundreds of these that could be looked at, and hopefully they will look at it in the next session when they do tax reform. But there's a great deal of money that could be brought in just by closing loopholes, many of which the wealthy are benefiting from greatly. And that's been closed out as an option at this point. The last two pension consultants and several task forces have said, we need to look at tax reform before we look at pension reform. We don't know what good options are for pensions until we restructure the tax code. I strongly agree with that, because if you close some of those loopholes, then it gives you a lot more options on solving the pension problem.
I think some of our representatives would agree with that, because I've heard one in particular say, cart before the horse, we need to do the tax reform, not the other way around. And I would also add to Larry's comments that we can probably also take a look at some additional new revenue streams. I've often wondered why, you know, we don't try to pursue growing hemp statewide. Why didn't we want to pursue perhaps medical marijuana? That would attack on a couple of levels, a revenue stream, and perhaps help the opioid crisis in eastern Kentucky. Alternative energy. Obviously, you know, a lot of people in the area are very fond of coal. But let's look at solar and wind power and those kinds of things as a supplement to our energy processes. So there are a lot of ways that have been done in other places to generate new revenue streams that we need to be looking at here too. Not just reforming the tax code, but new revenue streams themselves.
Creating new revenue streams like that, closing loopholes. I mean, those are all various industries in the state. So in some ways, you might just be shifting money around from one sector to another. With regard to the loophole credits to, say, the equine industry, if you were to close some of those, couldn't that potentially cost jobs or affect the economy in a different sort of way?
That represents a higher profit level. Whoever receives the tax loophole benefit doesn't consider it a tax loophole. They consider it an incentive. But yes, if you pull that money away from them, that reduces their profits. That's going to reduce a little bit the economic activity. So it's a matter basically of what is working and what is not. Most tax loopholes were either put in for political reasons or incentives. And I'm a big fan of incentives. But if you're going to give tremendous tax breaks for an industry to move into a locality, you need to make sure that your eventual payoff from that is greater than the benefits that you're granting them to come in for it. And I'm not sure that's being done really well right now at the state level.
You mentioned a tax reform, and here's a term that I've heard, and that is level dollar funding. Can you explain what level dollar funding is? It's my understanding that it enacts somewhat of a mandate to make sure that that this pension is paid for 100%, this issue is covered 100% in the budget. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a popular plan nationwide. A lot of different states use this method. Basically, what it does, it makes an assumption, in the case of teachers, it makes an assumption that the number of teachers will increase over the years, over the next few decades. It assumes that they will receive raises over that time also. So the total amount paid to teachers overall would tend to increase. The state would take a certain percentage of that payroll and set that aside in the form of contributions to the pension plan. The problem is that has not occurred. The number of teachers has not increased anywhere near the level they assumed that it would, and certainly the salaries have not increased anywhere near the level that the assumptions made as well. Consequently, the state ended up putting less in the pension fund than they had planned on putting in initially, And that led to, according to the consultant, about a fourth, 25%, of the entire pension underfunding problem right now. Now, to its credit, and I do want to give credit to this, the new plan that has been proposed would close that. It would move to a level dollar amortization amount, which means you would pay it off the same way you pay off your mortgage, which is the same contribution each month or each year on a level basis for 30 years. And at the end of that 30-year period, just like your home would be paid off after 30 years, the underfunding would be paid off and we would be back to 100% funding again. That's a good move. It's probably the best part of the governor's plan, I think.
This no doubt has ripple effects across the entire Kentucky economy. We're talking a lot about pensions, but I imagine there are quite a few people listening who don't have a pension. They're not a part of the system. They're hearing all of this and they're wondering, what does this mean for me? For those who aren't in the any pension system, what do they need to know?
Well, I think your question means if teachers have less disposable income to spend in their localities, especially the small rural communities, I think it'll have an impact of less money being spent because wages drive demand. And of course, maybe some small businesses will be put at risk, especially again in the small rural communities. These distribution of retirement and medical payments statewide, according to my last statistic, is right around $2 billion. Just in Callaway County itself, it's $28 million. So if you freeze that number or that number doesn't grow, then obviously that is a cut in disposable income. It's a cut in a decline in demand for goods and services, your good old economics 101. And so it puts some of these communities at risk in terms of monies being spent and jobs being created or jobs being cut on a variety of levels, whether it's a Walmart store or a factory down the road or just a mom and pop shop. So I think everybody, this is a team sport. Communities are team sports. And if one group is being subjected, if you will, to some pay cuts or those kinds of things, it's going to impact everybody.
And just for our listeners' benefit, we might point out, too, that may not be familiar with the governor's proposal. Part of the proposal says that there will be no cost of living adjustments for teachers going forward for the next 5 years. So if you're a teacher just now retiring, you would receive your check as promised, but you would receive no cost of living benefits, which traditionally have been in state law at 1.5% per year. They would not receive that for the first 5 years of their retirement. For existing people like Marshall and I, who are already retired, then we would not receive any cost of living benefits for the next 5 years also. Whether we do after that or not, obviously, would depend on the state finances at that time, I think. But when Marshall talks about taking money out of an economy, you know, this is quite a bit of money. Actually, it works out over a typical 20-year retirement period. It works out to about a year and a half worth of your pension that you would not be receiving, and therefore the incomes in the economy would be less because of that.
And you know, another thing, the statewide teacher union group, Kentucky Education Association, has been talking about the promise. Well, I think we can be more specific. It's an inviolable contract written in law that a cost of living adjustment is going to be there. And of course, if you take that away, whether it's 5 years or 2 years or 20 years, that's a violation, if you will, of that social contract. So I think we also need to take a look at what's written in law and make sure that the governor and the leadership in Frankfurt abide by that.
The inviolable contract, that's a hard word to say, but the inviolable contract was passed in 1993. And basically it said that for any state employees, the pension benefits that you were promised cannot be reduced between now and the time you retire. Technically, the state is saying the COLAs are not part of that contract because they were kind of added on later. So that's the reason the state feels good about taking it back. The original proposal by the pension consultant was that any cost of living adjustments that have been paid since 1996 be taken away, basically, which means that some of the teachers would receive a 25% pay cut if they retired in 1996. Their pension would go back to their 1996 level rather than the check they've been receiving recently. Fortunately, we think that proposal was not accepted by the governor.
There's other factors involved in this, and this is from Business Insider, and that is some suggested changes to the 401ks at the federal level. Now, this is, as the president has said, perhaps a negotiating tactic. How would changes to the 401ks at the federal level affect this discussion here at the state level?
Well, let me start, and Larry, you get into the specifics. And my understanding is that the tax reform discussions in Frankfurt are about trying to align our state tax law with the federal tax law. And so if the amount of money lowered that you could contribute per year into a 401k, if that was lowered from $18,000 to, I think there was a number thrown out, $2,400, that would hugely impact those new teachers or folks who were put in the 401k plan after 27 years in terms of how much they could even contribute. So for a new teacher, if you could only do $2,400 a year, are you kidding me? You'd have to work 150 years to accumulate enough money to be able to retire. So Larry, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. Now, technically, this is a 401A program that the state is proposing rather than a 401K. So we're not really sure if they're subject to the same rules or not. A 401A is limited to government employees. So as you know, at the federal level, President Trump and the Republicans basically have proposed that we have a tax reform movement. A big bill is going to be coming up fairly soon. If that were to go through, the proposal was that there are going to be tax cuts that are given to a lot of people. We need some offsetting tax increases in order to make up that loss of revenue. And one of the proposals was to do that at the 401k level by allowing people to set aside less for retirement in a tax-advantaged plan. And that's the situation that we have. Now, if you combine that with the governor's proposal, which says that 9% of the employee salary must be put into this plan. That's mandatory. There's no choice about that. And if you take the fact that they're earning in the low 30s maybe for a new teacher, let's say roughly 10% of the low 30s, so you're talking about $3,000, which already easily exceeds the $2,400 that they've been talking about at the federal level. So yes, there is a chance that this could potentially affect them and affect them greatly. It would certainly prevent the 3% amount above and beyond the 9% that the governor wants the employees to set aside. If that's the federal law, they would be prevented from doing that.
That's all of my questions. Is there anything that you feel that we haven't covered?
Well, I would just like to say, I feel for the governor and for the legislators on this. We have dug a very deep hole for ourselves, and we've done that over a period of about 17 or 18 years. I feel particularly for the new legislators because they're the ones who have to feel the pain of coming up with a solution. The older legislators were kind of part of the problem, I think, so less sympathy for them, perhaps. But I know that they're doing this in a good faith effort. I know that they're trying very hard to come up with solutions. I just wish that they would look at other alternatives, such as closing of tax loopholes and things of that nature, rather than having most of the burden fall back on those that were promised benefits and will not receive those now.
Well, I would add to that, I a little bit more philosophically, Larry, I feel for the student at Murray State University or Montana State or wherever who wants to choose teaching as a profession. I think we have here in Kentucky, and I've taught in three different states, excellent teachers, excellent school districts, excellent administrators and support staff who work hard every day to do their best by our children. And so my fear is that with this type of argument, if you will, in Frankfurt and a lot of the rhetoric that's being flown around, a lot of people are going to choose not to do this. And I agree with Larry that obviously these legislators are between a rock and a hard place. And our own local folks like Stan Humphreys and Kenny Imes are working hard at it. And we appreciate all that. And we've been to meetings where they've given us their, you know, their frustrated opinions about what's happening as well. So my fear is that 10 years down the road, we're going to have a very dilapidated school district in terms of employees and people who want to do this profession, which will irreparably harm the state for decades to come. So we've got to fix this and get it right, or we're going to suffer the consequences like maybe a Kansas that's pretty much declared bankruptcy and folks are not going into education, and I feel bad for those folks. And they've kind of tried some of this in the last 5 years or so. Again, take a look at what's worked. If there are good samples for that, and then take a look at things that haven't worked, and let's make sure we move away from those things that haven't worked and solve this the good old-fashioned way through a lot of hard work, a lot of discussion, a lot of debate, a lot of compromise.
Marshall Ward, Larry Guin of the Callaway County Retired Teachers Association, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.